and final time, we'll be looking at Psalm 23, as we've been doing a running series on this chapter in the Bible once a month. In this world that we live in, we're accustomed to things getting worse over time. If you buy a new car, from what I understand, new cars have a nice new car smell to them. And that eventually starts to go away, and then the first dent happens. And then if that dent takes away enough of the paint, then maybe some rust gets in if you live in Minnesota like I did. If you get a new phone, how many of you want the iPhone 5 user's guide? I think I saw one of those in the free bin at the bookstore a couple weeks ago. Nobody wants that anymore. If our bodies and our minds, they start to deteriorate and corrode with time. We live in a world that's just constantly, in a lot of ways, things just get worse and worse. But with the Lord, it's supposed to be something that gets better and better and better with time. And when we look at Psalm 23, this is, like I said, our final lesson in this. You can see that idea running throughout this psalm. And my hope is that as we've been looking at this, that this has been a great source of comfort, that maybe we'll never look at this chapter the same way again. Samantha and I and the kids have been watching Little House on the Prairie. Steve and Rochelle got us the books for the kids for one of Asher's birthdays. And so Asher's been liking to read those, and now we got the whole DVD series. And we watched the episode this last week where Ma and Pa lose their son. The son dies, and the kid was probably a couple weeks old. And Pa comes up to Ma, and as soon as they hear the news, they just quote Psalm 23. It's a very comforting psalm. It's one of those psalms that you might not even know how to articulate why it's so helpful, but it just is. In this lesson, we're going to be looking at this final part that talks about dwelling in the Lord's house forever. And to keep in mind with this shepherd imagery, maybe what this psalm has been doing is talking about the calendar, the full year of a sheep's life, where they've been out in the pastures, they've been by the waters, then they make this trek through the valley of the shadow of death until they get to the tablelands during the summertime, and they're able to feed on the tablelands, and then they come back down for a few months to the house of the shepherd. Maybe that's the imagery that's happening here, but we mentioned in the previous lesson that if you're somebody who's prone to worry and be anxious, like I am, anxiety and worry stem from faulty ways of thinking about the future. You're not sure how it's going to go. You really think it needs to go this way because you think you know the right way that it ought to go, and you're just worried that it's not going to happen that way. The very last verse of Psalm 23 is for the worriers and those with anxiety, because it's giving us things that we can be sure about. God's goodness and mercy will follow us all the days of our life if the Lord is our shepherd. And in this lesson, we will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Let's go ahead and read Psalm 23, and then we'll see what maybe David means when he says this. A psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Maybe the first thing to talk about with this is maybe to awaken in all of our minds our need for this house that's being talked about. If this psalm is talking about this journey that a sheep makes during the whole year, and then eventually it goes to the house of the owner, what this psalm is really about is it's about going home. It's about going home. How important is your house or your home? The idea of being home, there's just something very comforting about saying that. People talk about being homesick. They're not where they they should be, and so they get sick to their stomach that they're not in the place that makes them comfortable. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Up, but do you remember that the old guy in the movie, how he does not want to sell his house? He's not going to sell it. Because the people in the city planners are trying to clear away so they can make a big skyscraper or something like that. But that's a reality that a lot of people have in big cities, where there's people that have lived in a house for a long time and they're offered millions and millions of dollars and they just still won't sell the house. Think about homelessness. A lot of people throughout the last, I guess, 40 years or so have wondered, well, what causes homelessness? And they haven't done as much research on how traumatic it actually is to be homeless. You ever thought about that? The stress of not knowing what you're going to eat the morning that you wake up. The stress of being exposed to all the harsh elements. The loneliness that happens when you don't have a community of people that support you. Was David ever homeless, the guy who wrote Psalm 23? There's two times in his life. The first time when he was fleeing from King Saul, and he had to live in caves, and he didn't know where to go. And then the second time when David's own son Absalom is seeking to kill him. And then you can actually read some of the Psalms that David wrote during those time periods, and you see how traumatic it is for him to not have a home. Well, why is home such a powerful thing? You know, when you travel and you stay at a hotel, have you ever noticed that you have, maybe sometimes you rearrange some of the stuff in the hotel to fit your desires and the things that you want it to be? Or in your house, you have to sometimes rearrange things and make it just the way that you want. Your home is the place where your desires are the way that you want them to be. It's a place of love. It's a place of acceptance. It's a place of comfort. You know what's true, though? In this life, and I think this is something that David knows, and I think this is why he's saying this, is that if you have your house exactly the way that you want it, you've got the furniture that you want, you've got the family that you want, there's still a sense that something is missing. Have you ever heard the phrase before that you can have a house without a home? A house without a home. It's not really organized fully the way that you want. It's not exactly the way that you would want it to be. And the Bible teaches that we're exiles. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11, for example, says, "Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul." What is Peter saying here? That you've got passions of the flesh, sinful mindsets, things that you want to take into your body that you know that you shouldn't be doing that. You've got this war that you have to fight in this life, and as long as you're fighting a war, do you ever feel like you're really at home? You never really feel like everything's arranged exactly the way that you want it to. There's still a sense, in a way, that you have some kind of homelessness going on. C.S. Lewis, in his book, Mere Christianity, which, by the way, if you've not read that book, it's very good. The Bible's obviously the most important one. But C.S. Lewis says this in his book: "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger, well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim, well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire, well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing." Do you feel what he's saying here? You've got things in your life that you really have hope in, or there's longings that you have within you that some of us, we can put the pressure to find that satisfaction on our spouse. Or we can put the pressure on our job to fulfill that thing. Or we can put the pressure of that deep longing to be met on some kind of hobby or something like that. And then we put so much weight on all of these things around us. And then we just exhaust everything and everybody. And we find in the midst of all of that, that we're still not at home. By the way, David, in one of the next Psalms, there's a couple of these we could look at, but look at Psalm 27, verse 4. People talk about home is where the heart is. And I think the Bible would teach that home is where our hope is. Look at Psalm 27, verse 4, for example. One thing I have asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. One thing. There's one thing that David wanted. By the way, do you ever feel like your life is complicated? A lot of things going in all kinds of directions, things about the world that you just don't understand. And then David can just simplify everything and say, this is one thing that I want. I want to dwell in the house of the Lord and inquire of his house forever and gaze upon his beauty. Do you feel your need for this house? Maybe one of the reasons why we need this is because of the people that will be there. Who's going to dwell in the house of the Lord forever? Who are the residents of it? The first obvious thing is that it's the Lord. That's why it's called the house of the Lord. Pretty good idea there. Think about the story of the Bible. In Genesis chapters 1 and 2, home for Adam and Eve, for mankind, was a garden in the presence of God. When people talk about home, they talk about it being a place of love. And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. But our home was originally with God. Psalm 90, Moses writes Psalm 90, and he says that God has been our dwelling place from forever. Genesis chapter 3 comes along, and then sin fractures the relationship, and now we're distanced from God. Sin always brings distance between us and God or us and other people. And so what he's saying here, or what the Bible is teaching here, is that true home is to be in the presence of God. Fully. Well, how does the Bible describe God? God is the God of all comfort. He's the light of the world. He's the good shepherd. He's a refuge for the oppressed. He's the Father. He's the perfect Father. He's the God of peace. He's the God of grace. He's the Redeemer. There's all these different ways that you can picture God, and that God is described in the Bible. But if you were going to use one word that would describe what people in heaven will experience from God, perhaps the one word could be boiled down as love. That's what you want at home, right? You want a place where you're accepted, a place where you can be embraced and everything like that. And God is a God of love. The sun that rises every morning is a fountain of light for the world. And all the light in the world comes from the sun. In Minnesota, there's Lake Itasca, which is where the Mississippi River starts. And that's the source from which the Mississippi River goes. The fountain of love comes from God. It's him himself. And what the Bible's teaching is that when you get to be in the house of the Lord, you're going to be in a world of love. This is God's hospitality. Have you ever thought about heaven as an act of God's hospitality? Taking strangers into his home and letting them dwell in his house forever. Some people, by the way, say, doesn't it seem kind of narrow-minded and offensive that the only people that are going to go to heaven are Christians? To which I would say the only kind of person that would want to be in a place like this is the Christian. That's the only kind of person that wants to be with this God ultimately. If you're rejecting him now, he's only going to give you what you're really looking for. Now, that's the first person that's going to be in the house. That's the first resident. Here's the second one, is the Lord's people. You remember in Genesis chapter 2 that God makes everything and Adam has perfect communion with God. And then he still says it's not good that man should be alone. Even when it was just Adam and God, God still says, I want to make companions for you. I want to make a wife for you. And then you guys can populate the world and you can have human companionship. Ephesians chapter 2:19 talks about us being part of the household of God. The house of the Lord is the Lord and then the Lord's people. And the Bible teaches that in heaven, there's going to be a reunion. 1 Thessalonians 4:17 talks about then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. You see that the Lord is there, but then we're caught up together with the other Christians. By the way, why did Paul write this in 1 Thessalonians? There were Christians who had passed away. And they were dearly loved by the people who were still alive. And Paul, when he writes this, says there's going to be a time where you're all going to be caught up together, and then you're all going to be with the Lord together. Sometimes Christians will say, well, if we can't learn how to get along in this world, how are we ever going to get along in heaven? You want to know what the truth is about love on earth? Is that it's agonizing. It's something that we need, but it's something that's agonizing. You know why love on this earth is so agonizing? There's several reasons that we could think of. One of them is that we want to be loved for our own sake. Have you ever had somebody love you because they were trying to get something from you, or they were trying to use you in one way or another? You're not really being loved for your own sake. You're actually a stepping stone for somebody else, or an object for somebody else, and that's heartbreaking. Love can be agonizing because we want love to be mutual. Have you ever loved somebody a lot and they didn't love you back? Do you remember how much that hurt? Love is agonizing. What about the fact that we want our loved ones to be happy? When Asher was born, Lisa Adams had told Samantha and I forget how she worded it, but whenever you have a child, your heart has kind of left you for the rest of your life and it's bound up in your children. When you love people, you're only as happy as the unhappiest person that you love. Because when they're grieving, you grieve. When they're happy, you're happy. And so when you love other people, their emotions affect you. That's one reason why love is agonizing. Here's another reason why love is agonizing, is because we want to love people without ever having to say goodbye. And I don't necessarily mean just by that when people move. I mean ultimately when somebody passes away. Do you realize that if you die young, that's tragic? But if you live to be really old, you have to watch all the people you love die. It's agonizing in any way that you think about it. And you know what the Bible teaches? That when we all, as Christians, come together in heaven, Revelation 21, verse 27 says, "But nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life." Nothing unclean will enter. The idea being that God is going to perfect and transform people in heaven so that the relationships that we have in this life that can be agonizing, that we love people, but it's agonizing sometimes at the same time, in heaven, none of the agony will be there. People will really love each other for who they are. We're never going to have to say goodbye. It's going to be a perfect world of love with each other. What a great reversal. And in this life, we're only getting a dim taste of it. What do you think all of this would have meant for David, the writer of Psalm 23? I think maybe about his friend Jonathan. That 1 Samuel 18:1 says that David and Jonathan, that their soul was knit together. And then a few chapters later, Jonathan dies. Do you think that David ever thought about being with Jonathan again, his best friend? Or I think about after David sinned with Bathsheba. Do you remember when his child died on the seventh day? I always remember that because on the eighth day, the kid would have been circumcised and officially been part of the covenant community. He dies on the seventh day. And then David says this in 2 Samuel 12:23: "Can I bring him back? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." David was longing for a reunion with his child. Samantha and I always say that we've got two kids. You know what the truth is? We've actually had three kids. Because of the miscarriage. We never got to meet the kid. We know that it was born in our living room on a Sunday morning. We don't know what the personality of the kid would have been like. But we know that one day that there's going to be a reunion. Surely there's people in this room, and I know that there are, people who have loved ones. That there was times in your relationship with that loved one where there was agony. But there's going to be a reunion where that agony will be gone and everything's going to be perfect. Heaven is a world of love because it all flows from God, and then we're going to be transformed to love each other perfectly. Those are the people that live in this home, but try to think about how this home impacts us right now. Have you ever heard people say before that some people are so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good? I think the Bible teaches that if you really are heavenly minded, you will be very earthly good. Think about how hope affects people right now. If I hope to, I don't know, let's say I'm in high school and I hope eventually to have a good paying job. Well, that means that in the present, I'm going to try to figure out maybe scholarships, and I'm going to try to maybe figure out what school I want to go to and what degree that I want to get and all of those kinds. And I'm trying to presently get those things figured out. Or imagine that you have the hope of getting married. You've got the ring on your finger. You've got all of the planning that you have to do, and you're making steps to make all of that happen. If you have hope now about something in the future, it affects you right now. So here's the question. If we really hope in this house of the Lord, how is it going to affect us right now? I'm going to suggest the first thing is that if we really put our hope in this, we will seek purity right now. 1 John chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall be, we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. If you know that one day you're going to be made pure and perfect, and that's really what you're hoping in, it means that you're going to start that pursuit right now. If you know you're going to be getting married in a month, you're going to be pursuing that right now because your hope is in it. By the way, the very next chapter in Psalm 24, it talks about that same idea. Look at Psalm 24, verses 3 through 5. Psalm 23 ends by talking about dwelling in the house of the Lord forever. Psalm 24 talks a little bit more about the kind of people that go there. Look at Psalm 24, verses 3 through 5. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false, and does not swear deceitfully, he will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Do you see what the very next psalm is saying? If your hope is in this place right now, you better be seeking to be pure, so you can get a taste every day of what you're becoming. If this is really our hope, why would we ever bother to put all of our hope in this life? Or to be so devastated by things in this life? If this is really what we're anchoring ourselves in. That's the first thing that it does to impact us. Now, here's the second thing. We're going to have strength in the midst of suffering if our hope is in this. Imagine for a moment that somebody said, what's the hardest mountain to climb around here? I did Cowles Mountain, and that exhausted me, but whatever. All right, what? Mount Laguna. Let's say somebody put $5 million on top of Mount Laguna, and they said, all right, this isn't a competition. You're the only one that knows about this. Just go up to the mountain and get up there, and then you can have the $5 million. Would you do that? Do you suppose that in that pursuit of getting that money that your legs would get sore and that you'd sweat and that maybe you trip and scrape your knee or something like that. In the midst of all of that pain and all of that suffering, would you be able to have the strength to get up to the top of the mountain? Yeah. Because our eyes are looking beyond the current suffering. Look what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18. So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Paul says that his sufferings are light and they're momentary. Light and momentary. Well, what were some of the sufferings he went through? He was physically beaten. He was shipwrecked. I've never met a preacher. I know one preacher who was actually punched in the face when he tried teaching somebody the gospel. And that's the extent of physical suffering I know of anybody having to go through. If I was punched in the face for trying to teach somebody the gospel, or if I was shipwrecked, if I was on a ship, trying to go teach somebody the gospel, I would not say that that was a light experience. Paul, when he writes this, is also going through all kinds of heartache and heartbreak over the Corinthians and the things that they're doing to him. And he still says ultimately that this is light because there's the eternal weight of glory. The weightiness of what we're becoming when we get to be with the Lord forever, how we're going to be transformed to be glorious. By the way, you guys have heard me talk about this, but Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychoanalyst during World War II, and he was in one of the concentration camps. And because his mind was wired to analyze people, he analyzed the different kinds of people in the camp. And there was people that gave up. There was people that literally just died because all of their hopes were dashed. There was people that became bitter and angry. Because suffering changes people and it affects you in different ways. But he said there was one kind of person that was able to maintain strength through the suffering. It doesn't mean that they never cried. It doesn't mean that things were never hard for them. But he says that there was one kind of person that had strength through it all, and it was the kind of person that had hope beyond the concentration camp. Do you know, the truth is, we have the greatest hope anybody could ever have. And because of that, if we anchor ourselves in that, the suffering in this world might cause us grief, and it might cause us agony and pain and tears, but it will not destroy us. We won't lose hope. That's the second way that this house impacts us. Now, here's the third thing, though. We're not going to fear death. Now, when I say that we're not going to fear death, what I mean by that is like 20% we're going to fear death, 80% not. This is one of those things that you can't just say, okay, I'm a Christian, boom, I'm not afraid of death. Death is still an enemy in 1 Corinthians 15. Death is still an intruder. And so it's not like we're just going to boldly face it. Now, there's been some people in the past that have. But what I'm saying is this. The fear of death won't grip us anymore. The more and more we think about where we're going. Look at what Paul does with death in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 54 and 55. When the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? What's Paul saying here? I've seen one person pass away. Barry Kirchhoff and I went to a hospital when I was training with him. And Tim Beaver, I think some of you guys know Tim Beaver. It was his mother-in-law. And I saw her take her last breath. And this was the passage that immediately came to my mind. What is Paul doing with death here? He's taunting it. He's mocking it. Oh, death, where is your victory? Where is your sting, death? What are you going to do to me? Satan's biggest weapon was death. And then Jesus faces it head on and he conquers it. So that we can taunt death with him. There's one poet who said this, death used to be an executioner. But Jesus in the cross has made death into a gardener. You see the idea? Death used to be an executioner. He just killed people and that was it. But because of Jesus, every buried body that was in Christ will be raised up. It's just a seed now. It's going to be transformed. The truth is, the more I think about that, and the more I think about where I'm going, the less and less and less, and this is a thing that happens in degrees, gradually, the less and less and less, I'm going to fear death. Now, let me just end this whole series on Psalm 23 with a passage that we began with. We'll look at it now in just a moment. But the final question with all of this is, why can we dwell in the house to begin with? Why do we get access to this? You remember we looked at this in the first lesson, Isaiah 53, verse 6. All we like sheep, that's Psalm 23 imagery, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. The Bible teaches that we were like sheep that were straying. We rejected the shepherd. We didn't want to follow his lead. And so we didn't do what we were supposed to do. I had never seen this until this week. But this is a famous passage in Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 as a whole is a very famous passage. The very next verse, you know what it says? Isaiah 53 verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth like a lamb that is led to the slaughter and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent. So he opened not his mouth. In verse 6, we were sheep that went astray. And the very next verse, he became a sheep that didn't go astray. He became the sheep that was slaughtered. This is Passover imagery. The death of the sheep was what allowed the nation of Israel to live. Do you know what sheep follow if they're not following the shepherd? they start following other sheep. So what does God do when he looks down on earth and he sees his people not following him? He sees the world detaching from him. Here's the humility of God. He comes down and becomes a sheep. He becomes the righteous sheep. He leaves his home, the house of the Lord. He comes here to a broken place so he can open up a way for us. And we might look at ourselves, and the closer and closer somebody gets to death, I understand, from what I understand, Peggy probably knows a lot more about this than I do, but the closer and closer people get to death, they immediately start thinking about all of the mistakes that they've made. All of the things that they've done that makes them wonder, I just don't know that I can go there. What about David? David sinned with Bathsheba. He slept with a woman who was married to another man. And then he orders the execution of that husband. And in addition to all of that, David wasn't even a good father. You read about that in 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 8. He wasn't a good father. Do you think David could have ever looked at his life and gone, I just don't think I can go there? What about your life? The most mature of us in this room still have faults. You can be overall a really good person that still has some defects in your temper or your conduct or your words. None of us is perfect. And so all of us have reason to look at ourselves and go, I don't know if I can be there. Except for the fact that we were a straying sheep, and then the righteous, perfect sheep came, and he became the Lamb of God. Which, by the way, in the book of Revelation, chapters 4 and 5, Jesus is still pictured as a slaughtered lamb in heaven. Amazing. There's three worlds. There's hell. That should be down there. There's hell, there's the earth, and then there's heaven. Right now, we're living on earth. And for some of us, this earth is the closest we'll ever get to hell. And for others of us, this world that you're living in right now is the closest you'll ever get to heaven. The last word of Psalm 23 is forever. Forever. I don't even know how to wrap my mind around that word. Forever. Depending on whether or not the Lord is your shepherd and you've allowed Jesus, the perfect Lamb of God, to become the sheep that sacrificed himself for you, unless that's your hope and unless that's where you're growing, forever is a word that you got to think about. For those of us who are going to be in the house of the Lord forever, forever is something that should give us unimaginable joy right now. We're about to sing the song, Is Thy Heart Right with God? And this is a perfect song to think about. Where is our heart right now? If there's anybody that needs any help, please come forward while we stand, while we sing.